Blog Talk Radio. California.
Everybody, happy Monday. It is the start of a brand new week. Hope everyone had a fun-filled and safe weekend. Welcome to another episode of Inside the Octagon, hosted by me, yours truly, your favorite, Kalani Lua. You guys can find me on Twitter at KLua11. That's KLUA11. Whew, man, I got to tell you, when you start the week off on a Monday, you know, you get the Monday blues, you got to go back to work, or even though it's summertime right now, in the fall, you got to go back to school, and it's just, ugh. So hopefully, this episode of Inside the Octagon covering the world of MMA, hopefully it can bring some joy and cheer to your Monday, and hopefully start your week back off right so you can tackle Tuesday with a full head of steam. Now, this past weekend, as we talked about last week on the show, there was UFC in Chicago on Fox Saturday, which was a pretty good card. I hope a lot of you got to be able to tune in and check it out for Fox. So it's free, so check it out. But UFC on Fox, you know, it ended pretty well with two very good matches. In the main event, you had rising contender Valentina Shevchenko defeating former champion Holly Holm by unanimous decision. And man, oh man, these ladies was throwing leather. Valentina, she's a world-renowned Muay Thai champion, I believe a six-time world Muay Thai champion, if not more. She is one of the best and most vicious strikers in all of mixed martial arts, men or women. If you want to get an example of how she is, look at Joanna Jędrzejczyk in the women's strawweight division of the UFC, and look how dominant she is with her striking. Now, Jędrzejczyk throws a little bit more punches, where Valentina throws a little bit more kicks, but still in all, they both come from a Muay Thai background, and they've used it to achieve great success in the world of mixed martial arts. Some other notable Muay Thai practitioners in the world of MMA, former UFC kingpin Anderson Silva, a.k.a. The GOAT, former UFC light heavyweight champion Mauricio Shogun Rua, who was also the 2001 Pride Grand Prix champion, or 2005, excuse me. Vanderlei Silva, former Pride champion. Women badass Invicta FC women's champion, Chris Cyborg Santos, former Strikeforce champion as well. So Muay Thai is definitely one of those disciplines in the world of MMA that, if practiced right, if done well, and obviously if you practice and you train in all the other aspects, but Muay Thai has certainly proved to be, if that is the base of your foundation for fighting, you can achieve great success in the sport of mixed martial arts with it. So she was able to pick up a victory over the former champ Holly Holm, and I got to tell you, in watching this fight, I'm not sure what Holly's coaches, what her corner was thinking, but she did not have a good game plan at all. Holly Holm being a former kickboxer and also boxer, so she's very well versed in standing up. But one of the things that makes Holly Holm such a complete fighter, so difficult to pick up a win against, is her movement, her foot movement. It was put on perfect display when she dethroned women's queen pin, Ronda Rousey, last November. She, you know, circling, moving around, moving side to side, not staying in one spot, not being stagnant. She was standing still, pop Rousey, move out the way so Rousey couldn't counter. It was on full display, and it was beautiful. In this particular matchup, though, she chose to stay on the straight line and go back and forth, forward and backwards with Valentina, and you're taking on someone who's also a very good striker. That can spell danger for you. Now, obviously, in that aspect, you would say, well, the striking advantage went to Valentina because she picked up the win. Holm would come in, Valentina would tag her with a counter right hook every time. Whether Holm would come in, throw a feint, or whether she was coming in, she would throw a punch, Valentina would counter her with the leading right counter, which was landing the mark. She threw a couple of really nice side kicks in there as well. She even threw one hook kick that almost landed at the top of Holm's head, which could have rung her bell and knocked her out cold. So not really sure why she didn't go for the foot movement to try to move around to kind of keep Valentina moving, not being able to plant her feet and load up on her power chops. But be that as it may, Valentina got the victory. And afterwards, you know, now you say, well, Valentina, she's a top 10 opponent. She's 2-1 since coming to the UFC. Who should she fight next? And the obvious name, the big name that jumped off the board was, what about a rematch with the only woman in the UFC to defeat her, current UFC champion Amanda Nunes? Kind of makes sense. Nunes gave Valentina her only UFC loss. She's now the UFC women's champion. Valentina, who's 2-1, just beat the former champion. Hey, won't you allow me to avenge my loss? But not so fast there, I got to tell you. Valentina, who looked terrifically well. But I think right now, if you look at someone like a Julia Alapena, who is ranked fourth in the UFC women's division, and she should be moving up with this loss of Holm to possibly top three, she should be the one that gets it next. Juliana Pena, former Ultimate Fighter winner. She's 4-0 in the UFC. Came off a long, almost a year off due to injury. Came back to UFC 200 and got a very impressive win over Katsun Gama. She should be the one getting the next title shot at Amanda Nunes. For Valentina Shevchenko, it would be possible if she, I mean, not possible, but it would be probably a good matchup if she took on someone like a Sarah McMahon. Sarah McMahon, who just picked up a nice victory herself over Jessica Eye. You know, she's a former title challenger to Ronda Rousey, even though she lost. Former title challenger, Olympic silver medalist in wrestling. It'd be a good test for Shevchenko, and it'd be another big name for her to knock off on the list. Now, Misha Tate, the former champion, you know, suffered a pretty bad broken nose at UFC 200. So she might be out for the end of the year, if not the beginning of the year. So maybe it'll be too long for Nunes to be off. Nunes, who also hurt her right hand in that fight, it might be too long for both of them to be out for Valentina to get a title shot just yet. She might have to wait a little while. So who knows if she'll want to wait that long. If so, hey, Sarah McMahon would be a nice opponent for her. Or if Amanda Nunes cannot fight anytime soon and Juliana Pena doesn't want to wait, hey, what about a number one title contender match? Pena versus Shevchenko. That would be a pretty interesting bout. The grappling, wrestling, and scrappiness, embracing the grind mentality of Juliana Pena, taking on the striking, the precision, the accuracy, and the power of Valentina Shevchenko. That would be a pretty interesting women's bout right there. Sparks will fly, and it will certainly clear the picture for who should be the number one contender. And what at one point looked to be a dead division now looks like a stacked women's division. When Ronda Rousey was the queen of that division, she ran through everybody she faced. And outside of two matchups, her first one being against Liz Carmouche, where she initially won the title, and then a rematch with her rival Misha Tate, which went to the third round, other than that, she was disposing of all these women. First-round finishes, arm bars, TKOs, 16 seconds here on Alexis Davis, 14-second submission on Castellano, 33-second TKO over Beth Correa. So it looked like there will be no opponent for Ronda. There will be no equal match to her. Holly Holm came in and head-kicked that all out the water. But since then, Holly Holm, who won the title for Rousey, she loses it to Misha Tate. Misha Tate then loses it to Amanda Nunes. Now you got Holly Holm losing again, this time to Shevchenko, and now you got Pena coming up. Castellano, even though she lost, she's only lost two times in the UFC, she too was gone for close to a year due to injury. So maybe she can go ahead and get a high-profile matchup right after this. Possibly a matchup against Holly Holm, two females that need a victory, that both riding two-fight losing streaks. Maybe they can go ahead and jumpstart the win streaks against each other. But this women's division is certainly stacked with tremendous talent, exciting fighters who put on thrilling matches for the fans to enjoy, and they get after it. These women in MMA, they get after it. There is no stalling, stalemate, or no tomfoolery mess here with these women. They certainly love to get at it. And I got to tell you, as a fan of all MMA, women's and men's, I'm excited to see it, because a lot of you probably either remember or don't remember, there was a time where even Dana White himself said there would never be women's MMA in the UFC. It's not profitable. It won't bank. Don't need to get into all that. But now you've seen the complete 180 turnaround. Or would it be a 360? 180, I understand the difference. 180, you do a complete turnaround. I guess it would be a 360 because it's a complete turnaround. 180, it's only half a turnaround. So, okay, yeah, we'll go with the 360 analogy there. Sorry, guys, I went to public school in the inner city, the whole math equation and all that. Why can't we just keep it simple, huh? Wait, is it so hard to ask? Is it so hard to ask 360 turnaround for women's MMA in the UFC? Is tremendous, and it's fun to see. I, for one, can continue to be excited to look forward to future bouts in those divisions. As I said, Shinto, she could be taking on McMahon next, maybe Pena. Holm, possible matchup against Castellano to try to, you know, restart both of their careers. But I got to ask, was Holly Holm's victory over Ronda Rousey a fluke, or has she just run into a string of bad luck right now? Her loss against Misha Tate, she got choked out in the fifth and final round, which, had it gone to decision, she probably would have still won the bout by split decision or majority decision. The bout could have even been a draw, because I believe it was the second round that she lost 10-8, because Misha Tate just basically stayed on top of her for almost the full 5 minutes. So, but she was winning that bout until she got taken down and she got her back taken in the fifth round, and then she gets put to sleep. So, okay, so she was winning that. Okay, got put to sleep. It happened. And then this fight against Shevchenko, she just has a bad game plan. You know, she doesn't execute properly. She wasn't moving. She wasn't utilizing her footwork, her speed and her quickness, her lateral movement. She just stayed steady and stagnant on a straight line, which allowed for Valentina to just tag off on her at will. So, bad luck in the first one, bad strategy in the second loss. But now you're looking at it and you're saying, wow, was it a fluke that you beat Ronda? Or have you just been exposed in these two bouts that you're not as good as many of us thought after the tremendous upset? And I got to take a lie here. I got to believe that, no, it wasn't a fluke. One thing in combat sports, really in all sports, team or solo, but really in solo sports, specifically combat sports, matchups are everything. Matching up of styles, a clash of styles, it is very important, because we have seen both in mixed martial arts and in the world of boxing, there have been several times where a fighter who is superior in talent maybe faces someone who is very good, very skilled. They are not a B-level fighter at all, but they wouldn't be considered an elite fighter at that level. But for some reason, they give this specific opponent the most trouble. One example, and I don't mean to disrespect anybody that I've named here. These are just examples of the overall view. So if anybody takes offense to it, grow up here, why don't you? But look at Roy Jones and Antonio Tarver. Roy Jones Jr. being one of the successful, dominant boxers of his era, one of the most complete fighters of all time. He had the biggest trouble against 6'2" southpaw counterpuncher Antonio Tarver. So you look at that and you say, well, damn, he was flashy and quick and fast against everyone. But for some reason, Tarver just had his number. Tarver just had his number for some reason. Take a look at Floyd Mayweather. You look at Floyd Mayweather, look at his fight against Marcus Maidana for something that's a little bit more relevant. Maidana is a very good and tough opponent, but we wouldn't put him in the same class with Floyd Mayweather now. But given his aggressive style, his size, his straightforward, I'm going to come at you and bully you mentality, his power, it gave Floyd some trouble. It gave him some issues. But Floyd was still able to counter it and be able to come out with a victory, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at all. Same thing with Jose Luis Castillo. His style of fighting was very difficult for Floyd to be able to beat, but he did. So I think that was the same thing when it came to Holly Holm and Ronda Rousey. Holly Holm is a very good fighter, and she is still one of the best out there. But her specific skill set, the stance, the superior striking, the foot movement, the lateral quickness, that is a problem for Ronda Rousey. That is something that she has trouble with. And I know it's hard to say, well, it was only one time. Yeah, but if you look at all of her fights, okay, Ronda Rousey, her success comes from a straight line, bullhead, bull rush type of scheme. Okay, she comes straight at you, gets you with her power, because she is a very strong woman, gets you with her power, and then she gets a hold of you, hip toss, armbar, game over. But what happens when someone moves out of the way? She can't go on that straight line no more. Now, it's almost like saying a speedy wide receiver. Yeah, he can go ahead and blow the top off the defense and get down the field real fast. But what happens when the safety's over the top and now you got to cut in? Now you got to do curls. Now you got to do ins and outs. Now you got to actually run routes instead of just the go route. A little less effective, aren't you? Same thing with Rousey and the foot movement, the lateral movement. It's something that Holly Holm was able to execute to perfection. So I think with Holm, I think she'll still be okay. She just has to get back to what she does best, and she just has to get past the idea that, hey, maybe I'm not as good. No, she's still good. She is still one of the best. So for all the haters out there disliking or hating on Holly Holm, let go of your Ronda Rousey love and disappointment that she lost to Holly Holm, and stop looking for excuses to bash this woman. She's still one of the best out there, and I'll be very, very interested to see if Holly Holm and Ronda Rousey rematch each other again, how that fight would turn out. Because if Rousey doesn't make the necessary adjustments in her game, we could see the same effect. We could see the same result if those two meet up again, only because it's a clash of styles. And just what Holly Holm does well, Rousey does not do well at all. And that could be the determining factor in their next bout. But we'll see. We'll see. But be that as it may, she lost. Valentina won. And hey, we'll see what the next for these two women going forward here, as one is climbing the ladder and one seems to be descending the ladder. But before the women took center stage, we had a terrific, and I do mean terrific, matchup in the men's lightweight division as former title contender and former Strikeforce champion Gilbert Melendez made his year-long suspension return against one of the best and most fearsome strikers in the division, in Edson Barbosa. Barbosa gets the victory by decision. But I got to tell you, this match was very close. It was very well contested. It was very close. Both men were game. They were going at it. Again, they were throwing some heavy leather at each other. There was times where Melendez rocked, rattled, or he even dropped Barbosa at one point, but he rocked and rattled him a couple times earlier, although Barbosa was playing differently, but you can look at the body language and just say, there was a few times he tagged you and you said, oh boy, oh, that hurt. Ouch. Mm-mm, I don't want none of that. But the most vicious, the scariest, the hardest hit came from Edson Barbosa's leg kicks. Oh my gosh. Folks, I don't know if you've seen the movie Kickboxer, which starred Jean-Claude Van Damme. Everyone should have seen it. It's one of the best movies of all time. But if you haven't, go see it. Jean-Claude Van Damme, Kickboxer, tremendous. But in the movie, early on in the movie, when Jean-Claude Van Damme is in Thailand, I believe, yes, he's going to get ice because his brother is about to have a fight. You know, they're in the heat. He wants to get some ice, you know, loosen them up, get a good sweat going. Okay. As he's going to get ice, he hears this thumping noise. Boom. 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 Almost sound like Matthew McConaughey in The Wolf of Wall Street, huh, with the pounding on the chest. Boom. 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 It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. So as he gets closer to the thumping noise, it gets louder. And then when he goes into a room, he sees this fighter, a.k.a. Tong Po, kicking a, what would you call it here? I can't even think of the word. It escapes my mind right now. But you, a pillar. So there you go, a pillar. He's kicking a pillar that's in the building, that's holding a part of this building up and together. He is kicking it with no pads on, just short, bare shin. Yeah! Hiya! Hiya! And I mean, he's not even flinching. He ain't making no noise. All you hear is his damn shin hitting the pillar. And the pillar looks like it's saying, ow, ow, ow. That image that I just explained to you, that's what an Edson Barbosa leg kick is like. And I'm not exaggerating. He throws probably the most vicious, scariest, lethal leg kicks in all of MMA. UFC interim featherweight champion Jose Aldo, he's probably the only one that I could think of that can give him a run for his money in that regard. Because he nearly broke Uriah Faber's leg when they fought each other in the WEC. He nearly broke that man's leg with leg kicks. But Barbosa, if he's not, him and Aldo might be tied, or it's close to being neck and neck. For who's the top? He might be maybe one decimal behind him, well, you know, 0.1 behind him. But they are just they are just nasty. And Melendez, who he kind of has a boxing type style, like he, you know, he's a wrestler by nature, but he kind of has a wrestler boxer type style. Wide stance, throws a lot of punches, not too many kicks, but with his wide stance, with his league left leg out. I mean, that was just big. That was like putting salmon and honey. That's like dipping salmon and honey and dangling in front of a big old grizzly bear. It was just there for the taking. And Barbosa, he made sure he felt it each and every time. Afterwards, you could just see the welts on Melendez's leg. It looked like someone took a golf club or a baseball bat and just went to town on him. Hey, you going to pay me my money, Melendez? Well, bye. Just wasn't fair. But Barbosa, who now is on a 2-fight win streak, he's 3-1 in his last 4 fights. You know, he's certainly risen to being a contender in a very, very loaded division. The UFC historically has always had a loaded lightweight division, dating back to when BJ Penn was there, Jarence Pulver, Frankie Edgar, Benson Henderson. They've always had tough matches. The top 5, top 6, top 8, in some regards, the top 10 in that division historically has always been full of just fierce competitors, to where either one of those guys can beat the other on any given night. So he's risen to be another name to be known in that division. And where does he go from here is an interesting question, because his most recent loss did come last December against Tony Ferguson, who is another top 5 opponent in that division. He's vying for a title shot against the new champion, Eddie Alvarez. Barbosa did take that fight on late notice, and there was an up kick where Barbosa was still on the ground, and in MMA you can't throw a kick to a fighter's head when his hand or his knee is on the canvas. And there was one that did hit Barbosa that kind of wobbled him a bit. So there is an argument to be made. No excuses, just facts. There is an argument to be made that Barbosa, you know, he could get a rematch against Tony Ferguson and maybe settle the score, because that first one was a bloody all-out war, and it was fun. It was exciting. Those two went at it. It was nonstop action. I myself and the fans would not be disappointed if they did schedule Barbosa Ferguson 2. That is certainly a fight you could put as a headline of UFC Fight Pass card or UFC on Fox card as well. So that's another way that he could go. What was interesting is that, you know, Barbosa is Brazilian, but he does train up in New Jersey now. He did even call out former champion Rafael dos Anjos, RDA. He did say, hey, him and the RDA could go at it, and that would be an interesting matchup in itself. Two Brazilians going at it, two very fierce and strong strikers. RDA probably has the grappling ability with his wrestling and jiu-jitsu, but Barbosa is no slouch in the jiu-jitsu department himself. He just hasn't been able to show it as much because, well, let's face it, his striking is that damn good, and he's been finishing guys with that whenever he wins. And then also, how's his wrestling? You know, training up in New Jersey, he's training with Eddie Alvarez, training with Frankie Edgar and those guys, so he's getting good wrestling in. So you got to wonder, is it on par enough to be able to stuff the takedown or avoid the takedowns, rather, of RDA? Or if he does get taken down, would he be able to utilize his jiu-jitsu or the wrestling he has been working on to get back up and get it back to standing? But either one of those two fights, I think, will be extremely exciting to watch. Ferguson, again, that's another toss-up fight because Ferguson is a very high-energy, high-output type of guy. He's so unorthodox, goes for weird. I mean, their first fight in December, he literally was opening up rounds, just diving almost across the entire cage, going for a leg lock or a knee bar. I mean, just going for a rolling knee bar, and it's like, dude, what the hell? Like, what are you doing? Like a rolling monkey here. So, and he does have big ears, so me calling him a rolling monkey is actually fairly accurate, not racist. So, it'll be pretty interesting if those two fought again. The RDA matchup would be pretty good, too. But RDA did just lose, although it was a title, so it's not like he fought that far down the rankings. But I probably would like to see Barbosa versus RDA first, only because I want to see Tony Ferguson either get a title shot or face Khabib Nurmagomedov. Now, Khabib might get the title shot next, and if that's the case, then I'd like to see Ferguson and Barbosa too. But if Khabib doesn't get it, either give the shot to Ferguson or, you know, if maybe RDA gets a rematch or if they come up with another idea for who they want to get a title shot, you know, somebody else. In that regard, maybe Nate Diaz, which is highly unlikely given that his last victory did come at welterweight, but he did come back after being gone for so long in the lightweight division last December and get a victory over, Michael Johnson. So it'll be interesting to see where they decide to go with that. But right now, the only logical for Eddie Alvarez would be Nurmagomedov. Now, there could be a rematch with RDA, but if he doesn't get Khabib next, then it'll obviously be Ferguson. So if I'm Barbosa, it's either Ferguson, RDA, depending who gets the title shot. Look, if they give it to Ferguson, I know he wants RDA. Why not take on Khabib as well? Khabib would need a dancing partner. Why not? Sure, go after the Russian grizzly bear. That'll be interesting. So Barbosa getting a very impressive win like he did. In impressive fashion, he certainly opened up some doors for where he can go going forward, career, some exciting matchups to look forward to down the road. Now, on the flip side of the coin, there's a winner, there's a loser. The loser in this one was Gilbert Melendez, who was coming, as I said earlier, was coming off a suspension, which he got a drug test before. So now he came back, but, you know, Melendez is a former Strikeforce champion, one of the best lightweights in the history of MMA. On paper, he's 1-4 in the UFC. His one win did come against an exciting, thrilling slugfest against Diego Sanchez, but he's 1-4. He's had two title shots, and he lost both of them. And at 34 years old, you got to wonder, what's next for Gilbert Melendez? Does he change? You know, does he change weight classes? Does he maybe try to drop another 10 pounds and move down to 145 like a couple of lightweights have done, i.e. most recently Anthony Pettis? I don't know if he has the body structure to maybe add on a few pounds and fight at 170. I think he's a little small for that division, especially in the UFC, but we have seen Conor McGregor and we have seen Benson Henderson move up to 170 in the UFC and whatnot. So maybe if the matchup's right, it's possible. But at 34, 1-4, two title losses, you know, maybe it's time for Melendez to move on to another organization. Now, he is on the contract with the with ESPN as a MMA analyst, so, you know, he can always fall back on that. As I said, you know, these fighters, you know, they get to that certain age, just like in every other sport. They get to a certain age, you got to start looking at the future. So maybe he wants to hang up the gloves, step back behind the desk and the camera, and just, you know, work his magic as an analyst, build his reputation, his repertoire, and his work ethic and his resume there to become somebody big in that world. Possible, very possible. Could he move on to another organization, i.e. Bellator? Yeah, that's very possible. You know, his, a guy, man, that he's faced in the UFC, Benson Anderson, he's moved on to Bellator. Even though he lost his first match, he's getting a lightweight title shot now. So that's a very valuable option for him. He could move there, possibly. Now, it's not guaranteed just because you're coming from the UFC to Bellator that, oh, well, I'm going to go over there and dominate. But it is possible that he could go over there and find his stride, find his strike, give a Melendez style back, and really go over there and, hey, pick up some wins. Here's the thing. The losses that he's had in the UFC, outside of the one that Anthony Pettis, he really hasn't had a match, win or lose, that was bad. He lost to Benson Henderson. It was very close. Some say he won that, but it was a very close contested match. When he fought Eddie Alvarez, that was another very close match. Some people felt he won it, but Alvarez got the nod. He defeated Diego Sanchez with Anthony Pettis. You know, he got submitted in the second round. That's really the only fight where you could probably say where it was a one-sided victory, I mean, one-sided defeat, but at the same time, it finished in the second round. So it's not like he had a lot, it's not like it was a lot of body work to judge it off that. You know, you only had the round and a half. And then this fight against Barbosa, as I said, Barbosa got the win, but Melendez was very game in there. He was very tough. You know, he wasn't put away easily, and he still kept coming forward. So, you know, it's very possible that, hey, he just ran into a buzzsaw and Barbosa, who's on a little bit of a tear right now, and he's still a relative competitor there in the 155 division. So, you know, maybe he's just jumping back into camp, getting healthy, healing up that leg. Oh, my gosh. And then going forward and saying, you know what, I'm going to jump back on my horse. I'm going to get back up there, and I'm going to try to win. And it's very possible that he could find more success in the UFC. But right now, as I said, 34 years old, you're 1-4. You've had two title shots. You lost them both. Where is the real upside here for you in the UFC right now, Gilbert? So, you know, I'm never one to tell anybody that they need to retire, but I would say that if you're not going to retire, possibly a change in divisions or possibly a change in organizations will be better for you going forward. But be that as it may, it's going to be interesting to see what the UFC decides to do with Melendez going forward, because he still is one of the better lightweights out there, even though he hasn't had much success lately. Now, that was UFC Chicago from this past weekend, the main event, the co-main event. But coming up this weekend, UFC 201 pay-per-view from Atlanta. I think it's in Atlanta. Yeah, it should be in Atlanta, Georgia. I'll pull that up just to double-check, but I'm pretty certain this one's in Atlanta. But anyways, we are having Tyrone Woodley, the fourth-ranked welterweight in the world, former collegiate wrestler, taking on ruthless Robbie Lawler for the UFC. Like, yes. Going back to it, the UFC 201 this Saturday is going to be at the Phillips Arena in Fatlanta, Georgia. I knew it was him, man. I just wanted to be sure. But he is taking on ruthless Robbie Lawler. My gosh. Now, this matchup right here is between two of the biggest hitters in that division. And, you know, with Woodley, he's one of the most athletic specimens that's in the UFC. As I said, former collegiate wrestler. He even had a brief, small role in Straight Outta Compton, if you guys saw it. So, you know, he's been working on his movie career going forward and everything. But he's got very good wrestling, very strong physical. For somebody that's as muscular as Woodley, he has shown to have very good cardio in his bouts. He really has not gassed dramatically from what I can remember. Obviously, you're going to get tired. So you're going to get tired in any fight that goes, you know, three rounds or a distance, a full three rounds or, you know, two and a half, three tough rounds. You're going to be tired. But I haven't seen anything that suggests that given his muscularity and from his striking that oh, yeah, he's gassed, his cardio is weak or anything. Mostly with guys, especially in boxing and in MMA, guys who are very muscular, they don't tend to have the best cardio because the blood and the oxygen doesn't get to their muscles as much. And you figure you're that strong, you're just trying to throw hammers or lunge boxes at your opponent. And if you can't knock them out and finish them, well, then all the energy and gas that you wasted trying to finish them, now you can't replenish it and you can't replace it in time to get your second win. So, but Woodley's proven that, no, he can keep it. He's not really a guy that looks to throw a lot of haymakers. He's very deliberate in his striking. He likes to come forward. He likes to pick his shots. He does have the knockout power, but again, it's not like he goes out there just wailing big shot after big shot. He knows that, hey, this, if I can't finish him now, this could go a little bit longer than expected. So let me not burn everything right now. I don't want to hit the knives just yet, which is smart on his part. But when you are taking on one of the most feared, and listen, I am not exaggerating this. When you are taking on one of the most feared fighters in all of MMA, you don't want to waste your gas, but you may not want this to go distance. Because in his last three bouts, his championship bout against Johnny Hendricks, his first title defense against Rory McDonald last year, and his second title defense against Carlos Condit earlier this year, Rory McDonald has shown in the fourth and fifth round, he has another level. You could call it the ruthless level. But he has another gear, another level, and he just turns it on and turns it up. And well, he's 3-0 in his last three bouts, winning the title, then defending it twice. But he has put in his fight against Hendricks, he made Hendricks look like, yeah, Hendricks just is not in shape for this. He beat him in that one for the title. But then he has Rory McDonald, one of the greatest fights of all time in mixed martial arts. I mean, he literally hurt McDonald so bad, McDonald went down from a straight right, or a straight left, excuse me. Not because the punch was so bad. He was in so much pain, he couldn't bear it no more. And then Condit, who many felt probably would have won the bout if the fifth round didn't come. Because in the fifth round, McDonald turned it up, put it on another level, and he came out there and just stole the fight from Carlos Condit. It was right there. Roy just is, he's on another planet when it gets into those championship rounds. So for Tyrone Woodley, given his wrestling background, you would say, well, wouldn't it be better if he just utilized that to grapple with Robbie Lawler? Very possible. But as we saw against Johnny Hendricks, a collegiate wrestling rival of Tyrone Woodley, Lawler is not an easy guy to take down. You might be able to hold him up against the fence a little bit, but he's got very good takedown defense. And even when you take him down, he's very hard to hold down. He's very good at getting down. You've got to remember, early in Robbie Lawler's UFC career, he trained at the Miletich camp. UFC Hall of Famer Pat Miletich, UFC Hall of Famer Matt Hughes, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time there. So he trained with those guys for years and years. So his wrestling is nothing to slouch on. There's nothing to sneeze at. So this is going to be a decision of how to approach this with Woodley. Do I come out here and stay the course, stay strategic, tactical, mindful of my striking, pick my spot? If I shake them, rattle them, hey, rock them and roll them, shake and bake, go after it, or do I go in there, try to grapple them, try to utilize my wrestling, utilize my experience in that regard, grind on them, phrasing, you know, force him to really dig deep into his cardio tank to keep me off of him. As the fight goes on, it hopes of wearing him down. Very possible. Or do I just come out here and say, you know what, let me just try to surprise him. I'm going for it. I'm going Mike Tyson on his ass. I'm going for the knockout right away, and I'm going to try to finish this guy early. Because Robbie has been known to start fights a little bit slower, and that's possibly because he knows that the fight, you know, could go five rounds. He doesn't want to use all of his energy early. Very possible. On the other side, the champion, Robbie Lawler, who, as I said, he has just been a monster. 8-1 in the UFC since his return to the organization. His one loss, though, came against his first fight against Johnny Hendricks in a fight that, let's be honest, he could have won that, but Hendricks did win, so nonetheless. but he has looked unbelievable in his return. Training down in Florida with American Top Team, with that coaching staff, they really have put a focus into his training, getting him in the best shape possible, and he has reaped the benefits from it. And with him, he's got vicious power in both hands, those very good kicks, the body and the head. Like I said, he's got very good takedown defense. He's very aggressive. He likes to come forward. He has shown, as we've seen in the Hendricks, the Condit, and the McDonald fight, he can take a punch. You may wobble him a little bit, but he can take a punch. And then, as I said, you get into those championship rounds, the fourth and the fifth round, he just has another level that he turns it up on, and it is very hard for most to keep up with him when he goes there. So Lawler looking to make his third title defense, looking to etch his name out, and getting in the same class, not as close yet, but in the same class with his former training partner and mentor, Matt Hughes, with George St. Pierre, two of the greatest of all time. He's looking to be in that class, in that welterweight division, as far as when I'm the champion, I want to be up here. And also, you know, you throw in Pat Miletic because he was a champion as well. So Lawler looking to really make a name for himself. And with this win on the horizon, whether it's Lawler that remains the title or we get a brand new king on the horizon, karate and kickboxing ace Steve Wonderboy Thompson is waiting. And you want to talk about somebody who's looked amazing. He has looked terrific with his striking, foot movement, and his accuracy. I can't wait to break down the fight for you guys. Whenever the winner of Woodley and Lawler takes on Thompson, that is going to be a tremendous fight. I hope it's Lawler, only because, hey, he's fun to watch. He's never in a boring fight. His fights are extremely fun to watch, and he's a very tough, exciting fighter. And, hey, who doesn't like violence, right? So that'll be a very good fight to go forward. UFC 201, I don't want to say a bit lackluster, but it is, you know, the star power there isn't as strong as what it could have been. Originally for UFC 201, it was supposed to be the co-main event of Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson defending his title yet again on his historic title defense run. But unfortunately, he did suffer an injury not that long ago, so he had to be pulled off the card. So, you know, this card did lose a little bit of his buzz. It did lose a little bit of his zing. But be that as it may, the main event should surely make up for it as these two go at. Also on the card, UFC strawweight contender, top three challenger, Rose Namajunas. She's coming back into the cage now looking to get another impressive victory. And really to put her name in the hat to be the next title challenger for Joanna Jędrzejczyk for the women's strawweight title, given that Joanna defeated nearly all the other top female fighters in that division, except her and Nunez have not fought yet. So Rose Namajunas taking on each other, Rose Namajunas on the card fighting. That should be an exciting match to see her back in the octagon. She's got a very good, aggressive style. Speed, accuracy. She mixes up her strikes and her grappling very well. We saw her return bout last December against Paige VanVant that she knows how to mix up her striking and then go into her takedown and then also utilize her grinding pin. Excuse me. Whew. Oh, that's Coca-Cola from earlier. Utilize her grounded pound and her submission game on the ground very well, very fearful. So that is something that is really – she's someone I'm certainly going to be keeping a close eye on for that. excuse me, man, those burritos and Coca-Cola. Whew, oh, man, it's going to be an interesting run after the show. I got to tell you that. I got to drop the kids and the grandkids off at school. Little TMI there, but it's okay, y'all. We in this together. But, you know, this card in itself, I almost want to say, in a way, this card is kind of being overshadowed, though. And what's it being overshadowed by, you may ask? Well, UFC 202, which, oh, man, I cannot wait. I'm glad I'm going to have a couple of shows in between UFC 201 and UFC 202 to really get into it with you guys. UFC 202, headlined by Conor McGregor, taking on Nate Diaz, the rematch, the redemption, the rising, whatever you want to call it. that, I mean, that in itself is casting such a huge shadow over UFC 201. And in some regard, people are saying the UFC 202, that's the real UFC 200. That might actually pull in a bigger gate and pay-per-view buy than UFC 200 did. And in some ways, UFC 200, you know, it's kind of suffering from the fact that John Jones had to be pulled off the card at the last minute. So that didn't happen. So, I mean, you know, granted, if there's no injuries to 202, yeah, they got the advantage there. But be that as it may. And plus, UFC 200 was riddled with controversy. The Daniel Cormier lackluster performance, Brock Lesnar and John Jones selling their drug tests. It was a huge black eye on the event in itself and the promotion for UFC 200. So UFC 202, as long as it doesn't have any controversy, it should be better than that. So that's the big elephant in the room, really, that's overshadowing this. That's like, hey, Lawler, we are excited to see you, but everyone else, y'all can take a back seat. We want to see McGregor and Diaz next. So, as I said, we got a couple shows to get into, so I don't want to get into everything right now and just repeat some of it in future shows. But, oh, my gosh, guys, if you can, go on YouTube, go on UFC Fight Pass, internet source, whatever streaming device you use, go look up UFC 197, McGregor, Diaz, one. Excuse me, I had to think about that to make sure it was 97. I know it was 96, but I think it got scratched to 97. But go watch that fight between McGregor and Diaz, one. And, oh, man, you are going to see a tremendous bout that really lets you know if Diaz, who won the first match the way he did on 10 days' notice, what's he going to look like now with a full camp to prepare to McGregor? But then on the flip side, what's McGregor going to look like being that now he's got a full camp to prepare for Diaz? Again, he was preparing to face RDA at lightweight at 155, but the injury shortly before the event had to switch it up, taking on Diaz 15 pounds heavier. So now McGregor's had a full camp to prepare for Diaz to get his body weight right so that he can move up to 170 properly, because when he weighed in, I believe he was 166 for the fight against Nate Diaz. So even though I don't expect him to be like this, you know, massively huge welterweight given his size, but he's got the time to really prepare his body properly for this bout. And then, you know, he's driven by the rage and anger and the revenge factor of wanting to defeat Diaz this time. So, man, oh, man, that is going to be tremendous. But until then, we are going to have to be taking a look at UFC 201 this coming weekend against Lawler and Woodley. And as I said, that is going to be that could certainly be a barn burner, a slobber knocker, if I can steal the wrestling phrases from good old Jim Ross Jr. So, yeah, it's going to be fun and entertaining overall. Here's something I wanted to kind of dive into as we're wrapping up the show here. Inside the Octagon, brought to you every Monday at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You guys can reach me at Twitter at KLUA11, that's KLUA11. The show is brought to you by Daddy Green's Pizza. Just direct your pizza to Daddy Green's Pizza. Love that movie. Just love the last Dragon of Death. But I wanted to bring up something to you guys, to ask you guys, just give you a little something to think about for next week's show. And again, I gave it my Twitter handle, KLU11, so you guys can maybe respond to it throughout the week if you want to. But why shouldn't performance-enhancing drugs be allowed in professional sports? Now, I know how that sounds, and I know already the blockers and the windows and the walls going up on no drugs, no none of that. It is against the form of what competition is supposed to be, et cetera, yada, yada, yada. Okay. But I got to ask you this question. What's the downside to it? What is the downside to guys being on PEDs in professional sports? There hasn't been any deaths in these sports from that. I mean, guys have been seriously injured, but it's not because of PEDs. We've seen football players, college football players, they've gotten paralyzed from the neck down just being on the special teams kickoff, and they went down the wrong way, and the guy's knee hit the helmet, rattled their neck backwards, and bam, that's it. Was that because performance-enhancing drugs were involved? We've seen basketball players, most notably that I could think of, T.J. Ford, go up for a dunk, falls down, lands wrong on, you know, lands straight on his butt, butt bone and his spine messed up. Career was basically over in the NBA. Was that because of PEDs? Same baseball guys. One more pitcher getting shoulder and elbow injuries, needing Tommy John surgery. Is that because they're on PEDs? No. Boxers, fighters, and mixed martial arts, you know, tearing ligaments and throughout their body or breaking something. Performance enhancing drugs? No, not really. Pride. Pride MMA, which is based out of Japan throughout the 2000s, I'm not going to say that, yeah, they were openly letting guys use steroids, but I will tell you this, they were kind of doing the whole piss in a bottle, we're just going to pour it out and pour Mountain Dew in the next, or hey, pee in a bottle, but we're not going to look, so if you happen to pour some of that apple juice we left on the table into the cup, we won't know, hint, hint, wink, wink. No serious injuries came from that promotion. Guys weren't getting destroyed to where physically that they were just, you know, oh my gosh, guys would just get killed and, you know, all brain damage and broken skulls. No. In fact, we just had a guy this past weekend, at Bellator. He got a fractured skull from a knee to the head. His opponent that they gave him the knee wasn't on PEDs. So I asked, what is the downside to performance-enhancing drugs? It allows athletes to recover faster, which then gives us a better product on the field or in the cage, rather, for our professional sports, which we all like. And here's the hypocrisy behind that. We say we don't want performance-enhancing drugs in our sports. Really? Because were you not entertained by Barry Bonds during his historic home run season or Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa during there? Were you not entertained in the UFC? Again, not going to say they were openly letting guys do it, but let's be honest. The drug testing for the UFC was not as extensive as it is now under USADA before. They had plenty of guys who, some would say, yeah, they probably were on something, i.e. Randy Couture. No, nobody cared. You still cheered for it when football players were using it in the NFL. You didn't care. You still went to the games. You still supported your team or your fighter or your athlete or your school. It doesn't stop you. So what's so bad about it? Again, this is professional sport. I'm not talking about high school or Pop Warner or anything. This is professional sports. Why not? They're professionals. They're being paid to give us the best product and the best version of them we can see. Go ahead and take it. Sure, maybe you can put some regulations on it to say how much you can have in your system. In MMA, just a few years ago, there was this thing called TRT, testosterone replacement therapy, where fighters were allowed to use TRT in their system, obviously for what it says, to replace their testosterone. And they were allowed to use it. And guess what we got? We got a fighter like Vitor Belfort, Dan Henderson, and several others. And man, oh man, they give us some great fights. Vitor Belfort was knocking guys out with less hooks and spinning head kicks. Well, bam. It was almost like a Batman comic book or the old school TV show. You know, he throw a punch, bam, and the bam sticker comes up, pow, the pow sticker comes up. It was just like that. Dan Henderson with his H-bomb was knocking people out left and right, or at least giving those good performances, even on a losing effort, even though he just recently got a vicious knockout not that long ago. But still, there was no drawback to it. None of the guys that fought guys on TRT suffered any major injuries. And these athletes, you know, none of them suffered any real damages currently that happened to them then. And sure, we'll pull the whole, well, what about later on after they retire? First off, we're not forcing you to take any of this stuff. If you put something in your body that you know could possibly damage you and you still decide to do it, kind of on you, buddy. It's the same thing with smoking and drinking. But we don't care about that. A guy can smoke and he can drink. Oh, Ricardo Mayorga, the boxer, he smokes and drinks at his press conferences. Nobody says a thing about, hey, look after your lungs and liver. It's not good for you. Nobody cares. And then also, how about this? We want to attach our little league, Pop Warner, high school way of thinking into pro sports, yet they are vastly different. Guess where steroids is used at the most when it comes to sports? High school football. High school baseball. If you look at documentaries like Real Sports, Showtime's got one, I think it's called 16 Minutes in Sports. Look at some of the stories that they've done. Steroids is rampant in its high school usage. But, yeah, we don't want our pros to use it. And the kids, they're using it at that level because they want to be the best. They want to go out there and, hey, you know what? Let's go out there and let's do what we can. And I know, well, see, if the pros use it, then the kids are using it. Those same high school kids who are using steroids. Are you also throwing your hands up and being in a fake rage when they're having a party and they're all getting drunk, toasted, and wasted on beer, alcohol, weed, and other drugs? Are you also protesting that as well? What about the college kids? You know, you can't buy liquor or beer if you're 21. So you mean to tell me all those 20, 19, 18-year-olds in college, when they have those parties, it's only – you know, juniors, depending what time, depending when your birthday is, or seniors who have those parties, are you protesting against that? No, it's college, that's fun. So why not be able to take performance enhancers then? And if you have a car, you can go ahead and swoop that up any way you want to, Adam. Add the exhaust, you add the exhaust, you do all that, you make your vehicle as strong as you want to. You have a weapon, you can make your weapon as strong as you want to. You know, get a different caliber, go ahead and make it a hollow point, put that in, put a little kickback here. I got an automatic, I got an assault rifle, but I might have a shotgun or a grenade launcher underneath it. I'm going to add that to it, whoop out the bam. Hey, we don't want you to use performance enhancers, but you know, this food I just bought, this processed food that has all this enhanced drugs in it, yeah, I'm going to feed that to my kids. But God forbid if you play a game on performance enhancers, shame on you. Just stop it. I know this may be a losing battle or a losing argument, but again, open up your mind. Take out your high school and little league thinking about it and open up your minds to what are we really against here? Why are we really against it? What is the bad side? What is the downside? And if we're against performance enhancers because of health, the integrity of the game, well then why are we okay with athletes drinking and smoking? Shouldn't that be banned too? Because then isn't that saying, well, if this guy can go out there and play well drinking, then I'll drink and it'd be okay. Yeah, I'll have a couple. Rob Clemens did it. I can do it. Again, could be a losing argument, and maybe we'll dive more into it later. I'm just saying. PEDs may not be as bad for professional sports as one may think. But look, y'all, that's about all the time we have here on another episode of Inside the Octagon. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been brought to you via the Sports Crib. Be sure to tune into the Sports Crib every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, hosted once again by me, yours truly, by way of James King. So be sure to go ahead and tune in every Thursday. Follow me on Twitter at KLua11, that's KLUA11. Also, guys, I got a sports page on Facebook. It's called All Things Sports. That's All Things Sports on Facebook. Give that a like and a follow to get some good sports stories and coverage from there. Once again, you guys enjoy your Monday. Have a good rest of the week. I hope that you guys are tuning into the show on Thursday and be back again next Monday for some more MMA talk as we recap UFC 201 and start diving into UFC 202. Until then, y'all, peace, love, and soul. Peace.